Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, August 2nd, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And now let's set the scene. In the murky moments of doubt and anguish this November, who do you vote for? Why vote? This election campaign was such madness. How do I choose? Spirits, speak to me.
There are forces today in America that are trying to make it harder and more difficult for people to participate in the democratic process. I've always said the vote is precious. It is almost sacred. It is the most powerful, nonviolent instrument or tool that we have in a democratic society, and we must use it. We must get out and vote like we never voted before. Some of us gave a little blood on that bridge in Selma, Alabama, for the right to vote. I almost died. You must go to the polls and vote.
Imagining a scene there from a graphic novel, a dark and stormy election night, and I'm feeling powerless until that voice reminds me that I hold the ultimate power on planet democracy, because I'm a voter. That's John Lewis, the civil rights leader, longtime congressman. He is the star of his own graphic novel series called March. The third volume is out today. A romp through the comics with John Lewis a little later this hour. They aren't the funny pages. Also, voters need to be concerned this year about restrictions likely to be imposed or relaxed at the polls come November. In the past 2 weeks, courts have struck down at least parts of voter ID laws in four different states: Wisconsin, North Carolina, Texas, Kansas. Kareem Creighton is a visiting law professor at Vanderbilt University who focuses on race and politics. Kareem says guardedly that this is all good news.
Well, in certain states like Wisconsin, the challenges that were recently found to have merit by the district court really emphasized that the workarounds, the options that the state legislature appeared to provide for people who couldn't afford to have the driver's license, weren't really practically effective. And so that even on paper, while they were options that people had available to them to get some qualifying ID, the court found that they just weren't at all the kinds of options that actually most people could take advantage of and would therefore be serious hurdles, just as much as not being able to vote at all. There are some other states, though, where, as in North Carolina, the court found that actually the intent behind the statute itself, so in its very design, that the intent was focused on limiting the ability of African Americans in that state to cast ballots. Texas, the issue was about the access largely to the Latino population. But in those cases, I think what you see that the court is saying is the legislature can't just sort of gin up an idea that there is this thing called voter fraud and use that as an avenue through which to invoke any number of restrictions that it prefers to make life more difficult for people who don't vote for them and to make life easier for those who do.
Now that, it seems to me, is the second most important takeaway in all of this, that this issue of using voter fraud to justify X, Y, and Z restrictions on voting, kind of like using national security as a way of throwing out the Constitution, the courts aren't going to be buying this. Is that something that, or a logic that we're going to see more and more of as plaintiffs attempt to redress the changes in the Voting Rights Act that many found so onerous?
Well, certainly in the cases where you saw that the state very quickly rushed through legislation, either without doing the kind of evidentiary analysis to find evidence of voter fraud, or in North Carolina's case, where the state actually went out of its way to find the different ways that African Americans disproportionately exercise their right to vote by using same-day registration or by using early voting to go and vote on Sundays with the Souls to the Polls program, to then match up those restrictions, the court in North Carolina found was very strong evidence of intentional discrimination. And so when you see circumstances that track that fact pattern, I think you will find courts doing some of the same work for intentionality. But I do think, broadly speaking, that these circumstantial cases of intentional discrimination, particularly where, as you say, there's no evidence of voter fraud being a significant problem, is likely to find its way back to the United States Supreme Court. But note that the last time the Supreme Court of the United States dealt with this issue in Crawford versus Marion County, the court didn't seem, at least from a matter of theory, troubled by the fact that the state decided in a sort of preemptory manner to prevent voter discrimination.
If you forgive me, I just want to repeat that pattern that you're talking about, because it's really important that the court identified that lawmakers in North Carolina observed what modalities African Americans were using to vote and Latinos were using to vote, and realized it was the Sunday voting and same-day registration, and made sure the restrictions that they were enacting had a greater effect or a significant effect on those voters, and that indicated intent, and then boom, it's thrown out. That's kind of where we're at right now, and any other state attempting to do the same thing is probably going to find the same result.
That's likely to be the case, and this is one of those moments where evidence in this manner was used against the state of North Carolina. When you look at information about the way in which people vote, there's nothing wrong with that inherently, but when you find that the very restrictions you adopt very closely match all the different ways that a certain racial group tends to utilize the franchise, that just raises the specter of intentional discrimination. And the state didn't have an alternative theory that was at all credible to dissuade the court that that was the reason, that race was the reason that they adopted the particular vote participation regulations that they did.
What is the state of early voting, same-day registration, the kinds of flexibility programs that we've seen in states like Ohio, and particularly some of the real battleground states that are very distinct based on gender and ethnicity?
As far as early voting is concerned, it depends upon the state that you're in about whether or not it's robust. States like Ohio, the one that you mentioned, are currently being challenged for the way in which the election officials have implemented the rules. But early voting, same-day registration, these are definitely avenues through which people who are less affluent in terms of wealth, certainly people of color, older people sometimes, utilize more often than other groups. And so the availability of these avenues certainly will have an effect on all of these populations to be able to cast a vote in large numbers or, for that matter, organize other people in their communities to vote. And so I think that's going to be crucial going forward, certainly in the fall.
Now, I'm going to take your law professor hat off for a moment here. You know, in theory, we understand what we've been talking about. But in practical terms, if I'm a 75-year-old shut-in voter in North Carolina and I want to make sure that there's no surprises for me when I go to the polls, is there any activist organization, state organization, is there any source to find out how I can make sure that I'll be able to vote on that day based on my preference and anticipate some of these restrictions that are proliferating around the country?
There are definitely a few of them out there that do the work. In North Carolina, you mentioned there definitely is an organization there that actually is located in North Carolina, the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, which is one of the groups that actually brought the challenge to North Carolina's law. You can certainly check this organization called the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under Law, which has an election protection agency. But their election protection group is nationwide and actually gives information out no matter where you live about how you can vote, who you can call if you run into any problems at all. And the NAACP Legal Defense Fund also runs a similar group. But there are definitely many organizations out there, And I think if you are unsure at all, the best first option is to call and ask, because it may be, depending upon where you live, you are unfortunately run by a system where people aren't necessarily encouraging your ability to cast a ballot. And you have to sometimes go in armed, not just with your good common sense, but sometimes the threat of lawsuit. And to the extent that that's true, it's good to have backup with a lot of these organizations who can assist.
Based on what you've seen in the campaign so far, how much danger is there of a repeat of 2000 or some new scenario of too close to call in 2016?
Well, I think in this day and age, with the growing sophistication of both campaign technology and, frankly, the polarization of the country, it is never the case that you can dismiss the closeness of an election outcome. There's a long time between now and November. The polls now seem to be showing the Democrats with an advantage, but there's a long time with a lot of twists and turns that are almost certainly going to occur. So to the extent that state by state, the polls tighten, this becomes a reality. And more than that, it's important to note, in addition to the race for president, of course, there are any number of Senate contests and down ballot races where these margins may actually make all of the difference. So even a few votes cast or challenged at the polls may well become the subject of a lot of litigation. So I think it's quite important to be aware of what the rules are, and the work that is being done in challenging a lot of these voting rules actually can have great effect.
Are you speaking academically or from the gut here?
I think both, actually.
So you're a little worried.
I think any time that people who want to cast a ballot are not permitted, even though they are legally entitled to do so, I'm worried. That's a personal commitment of mine. I think it's a commitment that we should all value as Americans. And as such, I think it's important for us to get this right. You know, we're 16 years from the last time we had, I think, the meltdown that everybody now recognizes is a pretty significant frailty in our system. 2016 could well be the test to figure out how much we've learned since then. The courts can be helpful in that regard, but I think it's important before we even get to court that we have citizens and, frankly, organizations out there working hard to make sure that the elected officials out there do their jobs and help us get this all right.
Professor Kareem Creighton is a visiting professor of law at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. He also runs a policy consulting firm. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Later this hour, distinguished Congressman John Lewis on his graphic memoir, March, a living account of his experiences during the civil rights movement.
It is my hope that everybody will like it and love it, but especially young people, that another generation will see March, Book 1, 2, and 3 as a roadmap. That when they see something that is not right, not fair, not just, that they have the ability, the capacity to stand up and speak out and do what I call get in the way. When I was growing up in rural Alabama and we're asked about segregation and racial discrimination, my mother and father, my grandparents always said, don't get in the way, don't get in trouble. So I tell young people and even my colleagues in the Congress, it's time for us to get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble. You have to disturb the order of things.
That's later this hour on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
You sure didn't hear much of this style of conservatism at the Republican National Convention.
Things are here and there a little better, and things are here a little bit worse, and things here and there are really quite a lot worse. Since 1960, there's been a 560% increase in violent crime, more than a 400% increase in illegitimate births, a quadrupling of divorce rates, a tripling of the percentage of children living in single-parent homes, and a drop of 80 points in SAT. Manifestly, there has been a correlation between federal disbursements and the general welfare, but it has been a negative correlation.
In 2016, the Ivy League smugness of the late William F. Buckley has been absent from the GOP after being central to the brand for decades. After a major gaffe on Ukraine, Donald Trump is further proving that he has alarmingly little knowledge about the job he's trying to secure. Max Boot, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, thinks that Trump is the creation of years of the Republican Party's anti-intellectualism. Dating back to the 1950s, Boot argues that the Republican Party has worn a know-nothing facade to appeal to ordinary Americans. Now, Boot says, in an op-ed in the New York Times titled "How the Stupid Party Created Donald Trump," the GOP is no longer all talk. They have truly created a know-nothing candidate. Max Boot is here today to talk us through his argument on how years of GOP politics has led us to this precise moment.
Actually, it's been part of the Republican Party brand for a long time to be, you know, the just folks party. And, you know, Republicans going all the way back to Eisenhower have masqueraded by pretending to be dumber than they actually were. And by attacking, you know, elite intellectuals and snobs and so forth, trying to identify with the common man. This was a strategy pursued by Richard Nixon, by Ronald Reagan, by George W. Bush, by all these Republican leaders. But here's the difference. Those leaders were not themselves actually stupid or ignorant. I mean, you think about people like Eisenhower and Nixon. They were actually incredibly worldly, sophisticated, knowledgeable. The problem is that Donald Trump is every bit as ignorant in reality as his predecessors only pretended to be. You know, in a way, the joke's kind of on the Republican Party, because after masquerading for decades, the Republican Party has actually become the stupid party.
Is that to say that voters for Trump are stupid?
There's no doubt that he appeals to people without college degrees, the least educated segment of the population. They're not necessarily stupid. They're just not very knowledgeable. And I think they're being taken for a ride by Trump, who claims that he can solve all their problems when he can't. He can't even begin to solve their problems. And in fact, he will make their problems a lot worse with his policies, such as protectionism, isolationism, nativism, xenophobia. All these things will make America much poorer and much less safe. But I think he's guilt a lot of people into thinking that I alone can solve, you know, his mantra.
But when the National Review published this whole big thing about how Donald Trump, for a thousand reasons, could not possibly be the nominee of the GOP, it only helped him. That the more you say he's dumb, the more his constituency says, leave us alone, man, we're going to win.
Yeah, there's no question that he is appealing to this hardcore populist group, especially within the Republican Party. To some extent, there are some Democrats who fall into that camp as well. And so that every time they see those that they identify as being intellectuals or elites or snobs or what have you, anytime they see them denouncing Trump, it only makes them more devoted to Trump, because they think he's sticking it to the people who are sticking it to them. Now, this is, I think, a very simplistic level of analysis. We've certainly seen plenty of populists in the past. And, you know, in the past, many of them were Democrats, like, you know, Huey Long, George Wallace. But now all that populist anger has migrated into the Republican Party.
In the African-American community, there's a struggle between people who are high achievers and those in their peer community in the inner city who might view their advancement as a sign of, you know, lack of masculinity, that it's not cool to be smart. How far back does this go? Is it maybe even a reaction to the snobs of Europe?
Oh, yeah. This goes well beyond the African-American community. You have the exact same thing in many white working class communities, especially in Appalachia. I mean, there is a long tradition there of hostility to knowledge. And, you know, you can debate about where that comes from. David Hackett Fisher, one of the great historians of America, wrote a terrific book called Albion Seed, which traces the folkways of America back to the communities in the British Isles from which the immigrants originally came in the 17th and 18th centuries. And, you know, the people who are now settled in places like Appalachia tended to come from the borderlands of Scotland and England, where they had a warrior culture, but not a culture that prized learning. Whereas by contrast, the people who settled in New England came from a part of England where learning and education was much more prized, which is why, of course, you have all these colleges and prep schools and so forth in New England. Whereas, you know, in Appalachia, you tend to have a lot of people who sign up for military service. And obviously, you need both. You can't have one or the other. And I have great admiration for, you know, these working class whites who have performed so valiantly in our country's service over the centuries. But there is no question that there is a hostility to education there. And I think that is the core constituency that Trump is appealing to, because he's not just ignorant, he's proudly ignorant. He brags about how he doesn't read books. For him, this is a point of pride, and unfortunately it is for a lot of his followers as well.
If he were to win, what do you think the principal consequence to America would be in the early years?
You know, I can't even wrap my head around that. It would be such a catastrophe, because I truly believe that Donald Trump is the most dangerous and ignorant major party political candidate we've ever seen in American history. And I really regard him right now as the number one national security threat to the United States. If he were to actually try to implement these policies to try to expel 11 million undocumented immigrants, to start trade wars with Mexico and China, to pull out of NATO, do all these things, the United States will become much less safe and much less prosperous. Our economy will go into a tailspin. Our security will be endangered. I mean, I don't want to be overly alarmist, and I generally have not been.
You're a smart guy. I mean, you've written great books. You're a credible person, and you're telling me that winning the election is a precursor for Donald Trump to essentially create a dictatorship in the United States.
You know, I think our institutions are strong enough that you're not going to have a Hugo Chavez or a Mussolini or a Putin here. But if you look at Donald Trump, those are clearly the people that he admires. I mean, he's never had one bad word to say about Putin. He's expressed admiration for Kim Jong-un. I mean, these are his tendencies. And unfortunately, the president has a lot of power. So even though he's not going to be able to impose a dictatorship, I mean, if you think about the kind of abuses that we had under the Nixon presidency, you know, abusing the FBI and the IRS and so forth, I would be very, very worried about what Donald Trump would do. I've never been worried about this, but I am actually worried about this now.
Max Boot is the Gene Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
When Khazir Khan, the father of a Muslim American soldier in Iraq, spoke of his sacrifice for this country by losing his son in Iraq, everyone in America seemed to understand precisely what he was saying. But oddly, when candidate Donald Trump was asked about this, he talked mostly about success stories in his own life as examples of sacrifice. Greg Amira, a retired U.S. Army captain, was injured in Iraq in 2007 when several IEDs hit his convoy near the Iranian border. He managed to help rescue three of his fellow soldiers. A fourth man died in his arms. We wanted to know Captain Amira's impressions of all this, and we discovered that the idea of Trump, sacrifice for your country, and Hillary Clinton are tangled up in a complicated knot Amira may or may not resolve by November.
The sacrifice that I would look at is time away from the family. Moments, snapshots in your head that last forever. Child first walking, a child being born. For me, it was my daughter in school years. For me, it was the time away. And then sacrifice while I'm there is thinking of others before yourself. It's thinking of your brothers and sisters that are with you before yourself. In my case, in Iraq, friends of mine got hit really bad.
In physical terms, what of your capacity as a normal male of your age did you leave behind in Iraq?
I think out of everything, the mental toll was the worst. I don't care what kind of therapy you go through or anything, but that will be there. It's just something you learn to deal with. Physically, my back, 7 herniated discs. That's something that I live with every single day, walking, moving.
What about traumatic brain injury?
You have to understand, when I worked for Morgan Stanley, I was a vice president. I managed a lot of money in Wall Street, and my memory was great. Remembering all the clients, account numbers, phone numbers, account positions, stocks. Now, and I used to read everything, research reports and books. Now I haven't read a book in over 9.5 years. I get to the third chapter, you forget the first.
When you
became aware of Shakir Khan, that he had sacrificed, he and his family had made an extraordinary sacrifice of their son for the United States of America, and that by his calculation, Donald Trump had sacrificed nothing. Do you understand what he's talking about, and can you relate that in your own life?
I truly believe that Khan was put out there, like quite a few others, as a piece of bait on the fishing hook for Donald Trump to take. And he took that one and does like he always does, is shoot from the cuff, which is an asset and at the same time, definitely not an asset.
Isn't it part of the sort of DNA of being a member of American society that someone talks about that sacrifice, the first thing out of your mouth isn't, oh, you're a robot. It would be something, oh, I'm sorry. Or, I mean, there's like a thousand other things that you would say. And if you don't say that, then you've got some really serious problem with the way you look at military sacrifice and what the military is about. And I'm as cynical as you are.
I will agree to you. I will agree with you to some degree that obviously the ultimate sacrifice is the military person who died, and you can't thank them face to face. So you thank the spouse or the mother, father. Looking back at it afterwards, once this whole controversy started, I did have to say that it was almost as if he was a robot. It was pre-written. It was done by a professional.
It seems like if your first response is to say, oh, he was a robot, somebody wrote the speech, and what's going on with that woman there, Trump's just thinking about himself. He's not thinking about what was said, which was there's a sacrifice.
The only sacrifice that I could compare Donald Trump and his life is a man of that business success probably spent little to no time in quality family life to be that successful. And a military person deploys for 6, 9, 12, even 18 months with maybe a two-week break to come home. The difference there, again, is we have to do it that way. He has a choice to throw his hands up and say, I'm done. I can go home. I am more of a Trump supporter because I don't want the other person to be president.
Isn't there a point where somebody kind of fumbles around and they're off script and they say things that just seem so outrageous and sound so disrespectful to your commitment and your sacrifice and what's going on in the military culture in America that you kind of have to go, all right, I'm out.
You say you're out. I don't want to be a Trump supporter anymore. Who do you vote for?
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A skeptical Greg Myra, a retired U.S. Army captain, injured in Iraq in 2007. The headlines of the civil rights struggle in America were front page news in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. You would never find them in the funny pages. But you may not be aware that in 1957, a 16-page comic book, Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Bus Boycott Story, became a sort of Bible for a group of young people committed to nonviolent direct action in the fight for civil rights. And let's just say this man knows his Bibles.
We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now.
That's Georgia Congressman John Lewis speaking at the March on Washington, D.C. in 1963. He's now the last living member of that era's leaders of the so-called Big Six civil rights organizations. He was head of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And now, as a Yoda-like elder statesman, he has reimagined the comic book of his youth into a graphic novel of his own experiences. The third and final installment of March, a graphic memoir, is out today. Congressman Lewis co-wrote March with Andrew Iden, who's also a digital director and policy advisor to Representative Lewis. Both are here in the studio with me alongside Nate Powell, who's the graphic novelist and artist of March. All three insist that this graphic novel brings the history alive.
Andrew Iden suggested to me that I should write a comic book. I was reluctant, but he convinced me, and I finally said, yes, if you would do it with me. And it reminded me that when I was about 17 and a half, almost 18, I guess, that I read a comic book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story. that told the story of the Montgomery bus boycott. And this little comic book inspired me and many other young people to get involved in the civil rights movement.
So what was your vision?
Well, March came about in the summer of 2008. I was serving as the congressman's press secretary on his reelection campaign. And it was coming down to the end of the campaign, and we started talking about what we were going to do afterwards. Some folks were going to go to the beach. Some folks were going to go see their parents. I said I was going to a comic book convention. And everybody laughed at me, except from the back, I heard a deep voice, and it said, "Don't laugh. There was a comic book during the movement, and it was very influential." And that was the first time I ever heard about Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story. And it was John Lewis sticking up for me as he stood up for so many. And as I went home that night and read about Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story and learned about it, I became captivated by this idea of a comic book playing a meaningful role in the civil rights movement. And so here I'd spent days and weeks and months listening to the congressman tell the story of the sit-ins, the freedom rides, the March on Washington, the Freedom Summer, even Selma. So I started asking him, I was like, "Congressman, why don't you write a comic book?" And at first he was very kind, and he said, "Well, maybe." But I couldn't give up on it. I mean, John Lewis's story was so important, and here I'd grown up in Atlanta. He'd been my congressman since I was 3 years old. And yet I'd never learned the story of SNCC. I'd never heard the story of the young people of the movement. So I started asking. And finally he said, "Okay, I'll do it, but only if you write it with me." I went on to write my graduate thesis on the history of Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story, basically as a proof of concept that this could work. And what we discovered was that Dr. King actually helped edit that comic book. And so it was our model, because it had played a role in some of the earliest sit-ins, as early as 1958. It had been used by students leading up to the sit-in movement, and then it was spread throughout the country. And so we felt that it was very important to use history as our guide, much as John Lewis did, and frame March in that way. And that's what we tried to do.
So, Nate, what attracted you here to this?
Well, I remember reading a press release about March around 5 years ago or so, and they had already been working together on the script for a couple of years at that point. But it didn't occur to me, really, that the press release had an absence of an artist. And a few weeks later, my publisher gave me a call, and upon his recommendation, I personally tried out for the job with Congressman Lewis and Andrew. So it became a very direct, hands-on experience, getting sample pages of the script, doing demo pages, getting their notes a few days later, redrawing those pages, tweaking those. And within a couple of weeks, we realized we had a really solid team, and the rest is history.
Congressman Lewis, when you would look at the early pages from Nate, what did he typically get wrong?
I don't think Nate got anything wrong. Nate is such a gifted and talented artist. He is able to take the words from the pages and make them jump, make them sing. When I first moved to Atlanta, I became a member of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his father's church in 1963. And I would go to the church and attend his service while Martin Luther King Jr. would be preaching. And his father would say, "Make it plain, son, make it plain." Nate, with his pen, is making it plain. He's making it clear. So sometimes when I would look at some of his drawing in book one and book two and now book three, I have to put it down because the images are so powerful. They're so real. He's making it plain.
And you're not interested in just passing the torch to some, you know, Smithsonian archivist. You really want to pass the torch to young people in a way that it's alive.
Well, I want to see young people, not just all over America, but all over the world, standing up to help mold and shape a better society. We did it during the 60s, and young people today can do it.
Andrew, how can you possibly be inspired by the U.S. Congress of today?
Slowly. I think I've been in Congress for 10 years with the congressman, and I can't think of anybody I would rather work for. I think what you learn is that change through Congress is a slow process, and it's about being persistent and consistent, and that's what John Lewis is. Above all else, he doesn't stop, and so you have to have that sort of faith and determination that if you keep putting one foot in front of the other, eventually you will get there.
There's a lot of talk in the campaign, and we'll end it here, about America as the greatest country on earth, and there are plenty of people who say Well, that may be true, but you can't say that until you recognize and atone for slavery, the extermination of indigenous people, and all of the things that Americans have done without really thinking that have resulted in the deaths of thousands, hundreds of thousands, in the case of African Americans, millions of people. When you hear the words, America is the greatest country in the world, how do you process that, John Lewis?
I said to myself, and sometimes I have what I call an executive session with myself, as a country, we're good people, but we've made a lot of mistakes, a lot of blunders. The way we have treated Native Americans, we brought hundreds and thousands of people here in shackles, slaves. And even today, there's still hundreds and thousands of people that have been left out and left behind. The way we treat immigrants, it's not right and it's not fair. It's not just. To have 11 million people or more living in fear rather than moving toward a comprehensive immigration reform, we should do it. In my book, there's no such thing as an illegal human being. When the Pope spoke to a joint session of the Congress, he said, we all are immigrants, and we all are. We have to come to that point where we recognize the dignity and the worth of every human being. As one human being, I would not be pleased or happy or satisfied until we come closer to creating what Dr. King called the beloved community.
Congressman John Lewis, Andrew Iden, and Nate Powell, collaborators on the March Trilogy graphic novel about the civil rights movement and so much more. You can head over to our Facebook page right now to see a ton of photos from all three editions of March. That's facebook.com/The Takeaway. That's our show. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.